This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Beyond just, you know, stopping people from organizing themselves was the need to, you know, break out in terms of the media and international community to what was taking place during the night and sometimes during the day.
That's Dr. Edgar Munatsi of the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors of Human Rights talking about one of the recent internet shutdowns by African governments. Details coming up. Also, the share of women in Nigeria's government in the last 3 years has fallen to 6%. And Sudan's army says it will not let the state collapse. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, in the first weeks of 2019, no fewer than 5 African governments temporarily shut down internet access. Analysts say the shutdowns are now a frequent tool of governments trying to contain political unrest. VOA's Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
The last 2 years have been grim for internet access on the African continent, says analyst Robert Besseling of risk assessment firm EXX Africa.
We counted 21 shutdowns across Africa in 2018. And then so far this year, we've already seen in the first 3 weeks, in fact, of 2019, we saw shutdowns in 5 countries, again Cameroon, as well as most prominently Zimbabwe, as well as during the elections in Democratic Republic of Congo, and unrest in Sudan, as well as briefly following the attempted coup in Gabon.
Those 5 nations have one thing in common: recent political unrest. Congolese rights activist Sylvain Saluseke, who lives in self-imposed exile outside of the country, says his compatriots in pro-democracy youth group Lucha struggled under the blackout as they tried to carry out their mission of observing the nation's disputed, chaotic polls.
That was a major hindrance. Of course, beyond that, there have always been these questions of how less are we able to pass on informations or exchange informations. And that in itself raised the risk of if and when somebody has been arrested or somebody goes into any dangerous situations or risky situations.
Stopping the flow of information is the point of these internet shutdowns, says Dr. Edgar Munatsi of the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights. The recent shutdown in Zimbabwe took place in the wake of violent protests over fuel price hikes.
Beyond just, you know, stopping people from organizing themselves was the need to, you know, break out in terms of the media and international community to what was taking place during the night and sometimes during the day, because a lot of atrocities were committed during the night and during the internet shutdowns. If you realize, most civil society leaders and activists in Zimbabwe were abducted during the night, and no one knows up to now where they are, some of them.
Besseling, who assesses the continent from a business perspective, notes that African nations have an easier time shutting down or forcibly slowing down internet services because many African telecom companies are under state control. The shutdowns come at a high cost, he says.
If you were to shut down the internet in throughout the geography of an economically important country, then you can estimate, of course, a far higher cost. In a country like Kenya, for example, the cost would be about $6.3 million a day in case the internet was shut down across the country.
Those losses come, he said, through disruptions in information networks, such as internet-accessible stock and commodity price indices, and the unavailability of e-commerce and electronic banking. But, he said, there are other losses that can't be easily quantified, like getting reliable information about what's going on around you, or, perhaps hardest of all, losing touch with loved ones during a time of crisis. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Zimbabwe government, through the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, has announced that it will permit individuals and companies to transfer U.S. dollars electronically in a move aimed at easing foreign exchange shortages. Correspondent Adi Gondo has the story.
The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe says it has upgraded its systems to allow US dollar real-time gross settlement transactions. That is an electronic funds transfer that allows the recipient to get the money on a real-time or almost immediate basis. Until now, Zimbabwe has limited RTGS transactions to the local bond currency. That effectively kept electronic US dollars outside the official banking system. Zimbabwe abandoned its own currency over 10 years ago, adopting a multi-currency system with US dollar being the most dominant currency. Later, in a bid to ease liquidity and fund runaway government expenditure, the bond notes were introduced as having parity with the US dollar. Along with that, the RTGS currency system was introduced. The result was a messy currency and payment environment. Reginald Shoko is a Bulawayo economic analyst, and he welcomes the new plan.
The system, what has been happening is that we've been transacting US dollars through the telegraphic system, which takes more time, like 3 days to clear, and it's cleared in America, and then also the charges are higher. And then it technically meant that any transaction that was being done in US dollars was limited to cash, which meant that that cash was not going into the system because of the fluctuation of the bond and the rates. So people kept the US dollar in their pocket.
Zimbabwe will test run the system until Friday, and then it will begin officially, making it much easier for cash-strapped Zimbabweans to access their foreign funds. The implication for the man on the street is that there will be more foreign currency in circulation on the former system because Zimbabweans will be able to pay in US dollars. In addition, banks will be able to lend in dollars because they will have the reserves. Moreover, electronic transfers can be done more quickly.
So people can now pay their goods anywhere in the world through RTGS very faster. This is what they have done. So technically to the men on the street, there's nothing of a bigger benefit beside convenience. From the economy side, it's trying to get the US dollar into the formal market more than it has been doing now. There's temptation when we continue with the telegraphic system that people will hold on to the cash and they will never put it in the banking system.
That the trust deficit with the country's banking system will provide a challenge for the new system. What has been happening is that locals were relying on people outside the country to pay for goods and services, generally paying a surcharge of 25% for every transaction. The new plan is expected to encourage Zimbabweans to use the banking system more and more, and therefore help the government to retain money in the formal system. Foreign exchange trader Kudamanzanga hopes the government will not abuse the facility.
Obviously, we hope that it won't be used to those deposits won't be used to borrow money in the form of treasury bills. The Honourable Minister has said that they're tightening the fiscal belt. So from that perspective, it should restore confidence and allow people to settle. I think initially there'll be a demand for USD as people, when people settle, they probably want to do quick withdrawals, meaning that money won't stay in bank accounts for long. But as people begin to trust the system, we should see some sort of stability coming back onto the market.
Business organizations such as the Confederation of Zimbabwe Industries have been at the forefront lobbying government to allow banks to trade dollars. Bond notes now trade at 3.7 to the dollar on the informal market. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
When Nigerians go to the polls on February 16th for general elections, few will be expecting large numbers of female candidates to win. The share of women in Nigeria's government in the last 3 years has fallen to 6%, and the top female presidential candidate, Obi Ezekwesili, has withdrawn from the race. Timothy Oboyuzu reports from Abuja.
Nigerian technocrat Obi Ezekwesili was aiming to change Nigeria's political landscape by running to become the country's first female president. But she pulled out of the race just 3 weeks before the February 16 vote to support a coalition against the main parties. The move shocked supporters like Raymond Chinedu, who saw her as a symbol of new hope for gender equality.
In Nigeria, it is difficult to support a woman to that level. So that's where the disappointment comes in. But we believe if the men have failed all this while, it is our mindset that at least having a woman in the system, running the system, we believe that things will have taken a different shape.
Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission says women occupy only 6% of political offices. Director Oluwole Osaze blames cultural and religious factors for the shortage of women in politics.
Rwanda has a higher percentage. Part of it is probably because of affirmative action, because in their laws and their constitutions, they have things like that. We don't have that.
Ezekwesili co-founded the Bring Back Our Girls campaign in 2014 and openly marched against the government after Boko Haram terrorists abducted hundreds of school girls. The former education minister is also a co-creator of the anti-corruption agency Transparency International. It's a notable record in a country known for widespread corruption.
Politics undermines everything that we do in this country, whether it is what citizens do, what businesses do, what the society at large does. It undermines governance.
Nigeria's Election Commission said it was too late for Ezekwesili to withdraw from the presidential race and is likely to publish her name on the ballot. This could split some of the opposition vote, and it's unlikely Ezekwesili will even remain the top female candidate for president. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 5580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Analysts say, in Africa, shutting internet access is now becoming a frequent tool of governments trying to contain political unrest. And the share of women in Nigeria's government in the last 3 years has fallen to 6%, and the top female presidential candidate has withdrawn from the race. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The U.S. Africa Command says more than 2,000 military members for more than 30 African countries will train together in annual exercises known as Flintlock. The exercises will take place in Burkina Faso and Mauritania from February 18th to March 1st. African forces lead the yearly drills that include both law enforcement and military forces. Flintlock has taken place since 2005. It is the largest joint special forces exercise involving the U.S. Africa Command. This year's version is meant to strengthen security, border protection, and counterterrorism capabilities. Algeria, Morocco, and Nigeria are among the West African nations taking part. Other Western allies involved include France, Italy, Japan, and Britain. Sudan's army says it will not let the state collapse. It released a statement today after weeks of protests against President Omar al-Bashir. Activists have been calling for the military's support in their push for al-Bashir to step down. But General Kamal Abdul Marour said in a statement that the armed forces will not allow the Sudanese state to fall or to slide into the unknown. He said protest leaders were hostile to Sudan and are harming the country's image. Yesterday, a group of more than 300 professors and lecturers at the University of Khartoum held a sit-in protest. A spokesman for the group, Mahmoud Al-Hassan, told AFP that 531 university staff members had signed a document of demands led by formation of a transitional government. Officials say 30 people have died since demonstrations started on December 19th, but rights groups say more than 40 have been killed. Omar al-Bashir, who has led Sudan for about 30 years, refuses to leave power. Nearly 700 Zimbabweans who fled to Botswana during the deadly 2008 presidential election period say they are not prepared to return home given the new government's crackdown on dissenting voices. This follows recent protests over the sharp rise in fuel prices, which left several dead. From Gaborone, Botswana, reporter Martin Ngwena has the details.
The conditions at the Dukwi refugee camp outside Botswana's second city of Francistown are far from ideal. Refugees complain of hunger because of reduced food rations, as the United Nations High Commission of Refugees, UNHCR, has scaled down operations in many countries. Despite the deteriorating situation at the camp, about 688 Zimbabwean refugees would rather stay put than return home. The Dukwi refugees president, Bekimpilo Weza, says there is no way they will return home under the prevailing circumstances. Zimbabwe has recently plunged into fresh turmoil following protests over the rising cost of living, which left several dead and hundreds injured. The majority of the refugees fled Zimbabwe during an often violent and destructive 2008 presidential election. Weza says the situation now is far from ideal for the refugees to return home, despite both Zimbabwe and Botswana government insisting it is now safe to do so.
There are a lot of issues which people are looking at. There are some abductions and killing being done by the army and the police, although the government is distancing itself from the killings and arrests, especially on opposition supporters. People are concerned about what is happening here.
Over the past weeks, thousands of Zimbabweans protested after the government more than doubled fuel prices. That increase came after months of sharply rising prices of basic goods, along with growing shortages of food, medicine, and currency. The protesters at times turned violent, burning cars, looting stores, and blocking roads. The Zimbabwe security forces responded with a massive crackdown, beating people on the streets and firing guns and tear gas into the crowds. Hundreds of people have been arrested, and there are scores of reports of people being snatched from their homes at night to be beaten and detained. Weza says given the latest developments, some of the refugees who had registered for voluntary repatriation are now pulling out. He points out that most of the refugees lost their homes back in 2008, and although they are prepared to return home, they can only do so if it is safe.
People are not ready to go back home because of the situation. Not that they don't like Zimbabwe. They like their country, but they want the issues to be put in order.
One refugee, Wasuchiwi, supports Zimbabwe's political opposition. He says there is confusion at the camp regarding returning home. He says authorities in Botswana have told residents they might be forced to return if there are no voluntary repatriations. But he says they would rather wait for the forced repatriations.
So Zimbabwe is not yet good to return to, and we cannot go until we are forced to go. We are used to this type of suffering, which is better than the suffering back home.
The Zimbabwe government, in a bid to entice refugees to return home, has increased repatriation payments to $300 from $100. That carrot, however, has lured only a few back home. Both countries' government argue there is no need for the refugees to remain at the camp, as the political situation has improved in Zimbabwe, despite the economic and political instability. Zimbabwe's government has blamed the opposition for the recent protests and said it will investigate allegations of abuses by its security forces. For VOA, this is Martin Ngwenya in Gaborone, Botswana.
Ahead of a World Cancer Day, February 4th, the World Health Organization is calling for accelerated action to eliminate cervical cancer, a preventable disease that kills more than 300,000 women every year, most in developing countries. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Cervical cancer is the world's leading cause of death for women worldwide. 9 in 10 deaths occur in poor and middle-income countries. The disease is caused by the human papillomavirus and is transmitted through sexual contact. The World Health Organization says cervical cancer can be cured if the infection is diagnosed and treated at an early stage. But as with some ailments in life, prevention is the best cure. And in the case of cervical cancer, an effective vaccine is available that can prevent the disease when given to girls between the ages of 9 and 14. The WHO's Immunization Program Technical Officer, Paul Bloom, says the vaccine is widely administered in rich countries. While countries with the highest burden of cervical cancer in Africa and Asia are lagging behind, he says progress is being made.
In countries such as Rwanda, a trailblazer in Africa that reaches over 90% since 5-6 years, Bhutan that reaches also 90% of its girls, Malaysia that reaches 97% of its girls. So there are some extremely good examples that show that this vaccine is accepted and it can be delivered in low-income settings.
Bloom says 4 countries in Africa, Ethiopia, Tanzania, Zimbabwe, and Senegal, introduced the vaccine last year. He says 11 more countries in Africa and Asia will start using the vaccine next year. Princess Notemba Simulela is WHO Assistant Director General for Family, Women, Children, and Adolescents. She says a big problem in developing countries is the lack of skilled people to test and diagnose cervical cancer in women. She says that women in remote rural areas often have difficulty reaching clinics where they can be tested and treated for the disease. But she tells VOA there are strategies governments can employ to overcome that.
We can have mobile outreach clinics. Sometimes what you have is days on which women can be called or young girls can be brought in specifically to get this attention.
She says another strategy that governments can employ is to use school health programs. For instance, she says Rwanda and South Africa bring the vaccine into the schools where access is available to the largest number of girls in the age groups that need to be reached. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Shogun Chan, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast comes to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.